what is the CAS review? It's a systematic review to look at all the studies that have been done that are supposedly to prove the benefits of puberty blockers in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And why was it necessary? It was necessary because of the huge scandal that erupted around the GIDS, the Gender Development Service of the Tavistock Clinic, in which it turned out that kids were just not being given proper care.
Hello, and welcome to the Ann and Phelan Scoop from live from New York. Not live from New York, just from New York.
As live.
As live.
I'm Phelan McAleer.
I'm Anne McElhenney.
Yes.
Welcome to the Ann and Phelan Scoop. Yes, New York, by the way, I just want to say before we start properly, it's very, very loud. And people sit too close together in restaurants. That's my big takeout. But the thing that is amazing about New York is it's extremely exciting. It's not like any other city in the world. And I think you have that expectation all the time that you're going to meet somebody super famous. By the way, my sister bumped into Woody Allen about a decade ago, coming out of the New York City Library. And I think, or at least I used to think, that I stood at a traffic lights next to Dennis Quaid, who was really, really small. But then I looked it up today, and it's apparently he's 6 foot tall. So I've been living under the illusion that I did stand beside Dennis Quaid. So I don't think I did stand beside Dennis Quaid.
Didn't you also once get your hair done in the same place as Heather Graham?
How do we know that? Did I say that?
Yes. And then we also have another Heather Graham connection.
We have another Heather Graham story.
She ate Ross's flan.
She ate a lot of food.
Yes.
After shooting a scene in a movie where she had been basically not eating anything to try and look fabulous.
It wasn't a scene, it was a full movie, and she hadn't eaten anything for 3 months whilst we lived in Romania. And she came to our party after her rap party. She came to our party after the rap party.
That's how cool we are. Yes.
And basically hovered up all the food in the place.
Anyway, we are in New York. Why are we in New York, Phelan?
Well, we're in New York because our play October 7 opens this week. In fact,
it opens tomorrow.
Yes. If you're watching this on Wednesday, I know a lot of people watch it over the weekend as well. So it opens
Thursday, 2nd of May. In New York. So for previews, and the previews are going to run from the 2nd of May right up until the 13th of May. Opening night is the 13th of May, Monday the 13th. And then we run.
You can get more details at October7theplay.com. All the calendar is there. You can buy the tickets there. And then we run, as Anne was going to say, we run until June 16th.
And please come. And by the way, I know some of you have already been in touch and told us you're coming. There's three things that you can do. There's three things we need you to do. We'd love you to come. Buy tickets. We'd love you to tell everyone you've ever met and people you haven't met and random strangers about the play October the 7th. October7theplay.com. October7theplay.com. They get more information. And extremely important, we want you to donate to make this as successful as it can be.
Yeah. So let's. What else is on the show?
We're not above saying "I told you so." Correct.
But we're going to say "I told you so" about Harvey Weinstein. His charges have been. I may have said on Twitter he's been acquitted, or the charges have been, I suppose, dismissed against him. He's been found not guilty in the court, New York Court of Appeals. As we told you, the case was just not there. So we're going to talk. We're going to discuss what we know about the case, why this is a failure of journalism, a failure of jurisprudence, a failure of the rule of law, and why conservatives should care about Harvey Weinstein's innocence.
Yep.
And we're going to be looking at gender madness again, Anne.
Yes, we are. And we'll be talking to our friend Bev Jackson from the LGB Alliance later in the show.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the CAS report. How is this the beginning of the end for mutilating children in the name of progress, which is happening probably in a town close to you.
And just it's just fascinating and just interesting detail that, you know, the UK really are leading the world and will be looked back on in history and should be very, very proud, because I think this whole madness will be broken, and it'll be broken by the developments that are happening in the United Kingdom. Yes. So, and Bev Jackson very much at the centre of it.
So we'll have that interview later. So we can't believe as we record this, we're just a few days from the first performance of our play, October 7th. The first show is tomorrow. If you're seeing this on Wednesday, the first show is tomorrow, Thursday, May the 2nd. Obviously, just to remind you what the play is about, We went to Israel after October 7th. We interviewed survivors, heroes, people who fought back, people who lost family members, people who witnessed the most horrific things, people who witnessed the most heroic things, people who did heroic things, people who have showed incredible resilience, people who actually found humor in the darkness. An amazing experience to go and interview these people. We've boiled their stories down into a play. It was about 12, 13 characters, each of them really telling the story of October 7th bit by bit. And some of the stories are connected, some of them are standalone. And and we've put it into a compelling drama. So it's going to be on stage in the Actors Temple Theatre, 339 West 47th Street. Let's play the trailer for the play. This will give you it's never been more relevant as the universities descend further into madness and darkness. But let's play the trailer now.
The world wants you to forget what happened in Israel on October 7th. We've covered many shocking stories, but nothing comes close to what the men, women and children of Israel faced that day. We're investigative journalists, Anne McElhenney and Phelan McAleer.
We travelled to Israel after October the 7th and talked to those who lived through that day. Their stories are tragic, they are moving and they are heroic. They are also very, very compelling.
We've produced a play from their stories. Our verbatim play, October 7, consists entirely of eyewitness accounts of that day, only using the actual words of those who lived through it. The world wants you to forget about what happened that day, the day that everything changed. We refuse to let that happen.
October 7, the play, is opening in New York and will bring you the truth they don't want you to hear.
Get your tickets now for October 7, the play, at October7theplay.com, running May 2nd to June 16th in New York.
That's October7theplay.com. Thank you.
Yeah, and as Phelan says, you know, the universities have gone mad, particularly here in New York, as everybody probably knows about what's happening at Columbia. You know, they even had a situation with a Jewish professor who was barred entry. You know, a Jewish professor, his name is Shai Davida. And he tried to gain entry, legitimately. His ID, by the way, has been they've deactivated his ID for his own safety, apparently.
Yes.
But people are basically saying, when was the last time something similar to this like this happened? And unfortunately, I think it doesn't take much to guess when that happened.
Yeah. No, why don't they deactivate the ID of the protesters?
Correct. Yeah.
So anyway, the This is a dark day for America. It's a dark time for America. The anti-Semitism that is arising is shocking. It is shocking, but it's shocking. By the way, some people said we should work with the Anti-Defamation League and that to promote the play. But look, the Anti-Defamation League, during the Trump presidency, kept saying, oh, there's a rise in anti-Semitism, there's a rise in anti-Semitism. I was looking around. There was no rise in anti-Semitism. There was this period of Jews being attacked in New York. Remember that? And they kept going, oh, rise in anti-Semitism, and showing pictures of guys in white pickup trucks. And there was TV ads with guys in white pickup trucks. And look, you could see the videos, and no one was saying it. The people attacking the Orthodox Jews in New York were African Americans. The rise in anti-Semitism was from the left, not from the right.
Mm-hmm.
And October 7th, for some reason, has allowed people to be openly anti-Semitic, to show their anti-Semitism in full view, and that's what we're witnessing. The Anti-Defamation League got involved in, and we'll talk about this later, got involved in things like trans rights and racism and all that, and as Juliana Margulies, remember that actress, said, you know, I was out marching for George Floyd, I did this on my Instagram, and where are they now? I'll tell you where they are now. They're sticking their boot in your face, Juliana Margulies.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't like Jews. You may have been out there to support them, you may have, and by the way, the civil rights organization was led by Jews. The intellectual rigor behind it was the media. That's one thing the civil rights organizations did really well, was use the media, use this newfangled thing called television. Mm. And that was all I would say, Jewish expertise, you know, from the entertainment industry. And what did they get in return? You know, we see it. And
it's ugly and it's scary. And it seems to have happened just overnight.
Yes.
But it's very scary.
Yes. So October 7th, the play, come to it.
Share and donate.
Yeah, it's a tough play, but it's not depressing. It's actually
uplifting.
It's uplifting, believe it or not.
Yeah.
It's people show resilience in the face of truly awful things. People show that they're not
resolve.
Going to take it.
Yeah, Dennis Prager, I was interviewed by Dennis Prager, and he said to me, did anyone that you interviewed in Israel, did anyone break down in tears or whatever? And I said, actually, and it was an interesting question. I said, nobody I interviewed broke down in tears, but I do remember my big takeaway was people were very resolved. People, there was resilience and resolve and strength among the people that we spoke to.
Yeah.
And you'll see that on stage. It's very, very powerful. We've been to the rehearsals in the last couple of weeks and it's been just inspiring and amazing. So we're very excited to bring this play to the world. So we've had a very big week, by the way. So we've had quite a big vindication this week of the work that we did on the Harvey Weinstein trial. As you know, we went to the Harvey Weinstein trial every day here in New York back in the day. How many years ago was that film? It was just before COVID.
It was just pre-pandemic. It was February and early March of 2020. And last week, the New York Court of Appeals overturned Harvey Weinstein's rape and sexual assault conviction, shocking everyone on the planet except us. We, as you say, we made a whole podcast on the trial, the Harvey Weinstein trial unfiltered. If you listen to it, you'll see why we weren't surprised at all.
Yes.
And just to prove, you know, just to all you doubters out there, we've put together a little medley of clips to show that before the
appeals court said anything.
Yes, before they threw the conviction out, we were saying he is innocent. So this is us on Prager, this is us on the Mark Stein show, this is us on a variety of shows talking about this. So let's hear the little clip we put together.
Tell everybody why you're at the trial.
You know, I think, you know, liberal mob justice is liberal mob justice if it's applied to Brett Kavanaugh or if it's applied to Harvey Weinstein. And there is a mob mentality going on here. You know, even when they were choosing the jury, they had a flash mob of women who, you know, chanted really loudly outside the court that could be heard within the court, you are the rapist, you know, you are a rapist. So, you know, people deserve due process no matter who they are.
Last hour, I read to my audience a piece in, of all places, The Nation, saying that feminists and the Me Too movement better be prepared for either a hung jury or an acquittal. Obviously, neither happened. Are you surprised?
Yes, shocked, actually. The evidence just wasn't there. This is a political decision, and I don't mean the jury is overtly political, but they have absorbed the political culture, the Me Too movement. And it seems that you can now redefine consensual sex several years later as sexual assault. And I don't mean that in a nasty way. Both of the victims admitted to having consensual sexual relations with Harvey Weinstein, but then they said other relations were not consensual. They wrote loving emails to him.
It was quite extraordinary. I mean, basically anything, you know, I'm just looking at stuff just right now because we're organizing for our podcast again this evening. Just looking at what these women, these alleged victims, who now have been, you know, who have been, you know, justified with this verdict, their behavior after these alleged assaults is beyond understanding. It's beyond. I think that was what the jury were being asked to bring a common sense, and I don't think we have evidence of that here. It's extraordinary. I'm not that I like Harvey Weinstein. Not that I think he's a good guy or any of that. But this is extraordinary stuff.
They both went to the Harvey Weinstein trial, and they broadcast each day some of the testimony. When we last spoke, Anne, you and not only you, I mean others who had heard the testimony, they thought that he might not be convicted. What happened?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly as you say. Anyone who sat in that court, I think, who had any, you know, modicum of sense or common sense, would have believed that he would have walked, that the case should never have come to court at all in the first place, given the two women that were accusing him. However, that's of course not the case, because we're living in highly politicized times where mob justice is what, you know, is rules the day. And he's got 23 years. 20 years for one of the assaults, one of these alleged assaults that are now he's been convicted of, and 3 years to run consecutively.
I think he's a pig, you know, I don't know if that's a technical term. I think he's without a doubt a pig, and the world's full of them. And he's, you know, lots of expletives that you could use, and lots of those kind of words that women use about men. I think he's a pig might be a good one to describe. And there's no woman alive who hasn't met a pig. So, but it's not a criminal thing to be a pig. And actually, it's amazing, actually, how much you can do to someone that's not actually criminal at all. What the kind of things you can say to someone, the way you can behave. And that for me, it felt like most of what I thought happened was transactional, that these women were not the innocents that they claimed to be.
I've always hated this thing of journalism is about comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. No, sorry, afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted. And I'm going, sometimes the afflicted are assholes. You know, it's not your job to comfort them. It's actually,
or the afflicted might be guilty.
And the comfortable might be
virtuous
and nice people and wrongly accused of something. So it's not your job to afflict anyone or comfort anyone. It's just to find out the truth and talk to everyone.
There you have it.
So, yeah. So, I mean, let's go over what the appeal court said. I mean, and by the way, it's a mostly female New York appeals court. They said the trial judge made significant errors during the case, and Weinstein is now entitled to a retrial. In fact, I would say they didn't say significant. They said egregious.
Egregious.
That's my word of the week, egregious. You know, and the answer is, of course he did. You could see, I mean, to me, the most stunning part, or the most interesting part of the wild was, you know, but a part of the trial that really got to me was in the last day when the defense lawyer asked to open a window to let some air in
because it was really hot inside in the
and
courtroom.
The judge looked at her and said no, and she just looked, and I was thinking she was really frustrated. She said, judge, can you at least give me something during this trial?
Yeah.
And you don't say that to a judge, because that makes the judge angry and sentences your client probably to more than he's entitled or whatever. But I felt that was an example. They were kept saying, judge, you can't let these witnesses in to give what's called Molyneux testimony.
The Molyneux witnesses, who are people, you know, who were going to, you know, prove prior bad acts. You know, we're going to tell stories about Harvey Weinstein. And the stories didn't involve anything that was being prosecuted again. You know, he wasn't being prosecuted for any of these stories.
Yes.
And so, but they got to get to tell these stories, including Annabella Sciorra, who's, you know, one of the most famous names that was in these Molyneux witnesses. And she was, you know, she was in The Sopranos in the day.
Can I just say something? So he was convicted of two assaults, right? But I think there was like five women testifying against him, right?
But there were also other women, and those other charges were thrown out, by the way. So it ended up he was just facing two women at the end in New York.
No, but in the trial, you heard from multiple women,
yes,
right?
Molyneux
so the witness. Impression, but he was only actually charged with two. So the impression was there was all these charges and all these women, but their cases weren't strong enough, or they were outside the statute of limitations. They couldn't be brought to a trial. So somehow the judge allowed these women in, even though their evidence should never have been heard. I mean, really, if Weinstein had been, he was charged with two assaults, if that evidence had been heard in all its ridiculousness, then I think maybe the jury would have there might have been a mistrial, because it could have been a hung jury. But actually, it even gets back to the original sin. This case should never have been brought,
yes,
because there was all these cases in the media. And when the investigators went to investigate, they found just hole after hole after hole in the case. Then the case should never have been in the center of New York. I mean, we talked about it earlier. Like, if you spend any time in New York, you meet a raft of celebrities. You spend any time in New York, you know someone who's worked for the Weinstein Company, or
yes,
know someone.
So the idea of him getting a fair trial here or getting a jury that wouldn't have some kind of, you know, tenuous connection with him.
Also, there was a mob atmosphere.
And there was a mob. There was an actual mob. There was an actual mob outside the courtroom a lot of the time, chanting and could be almost heard inside the courtroom on occasions. But the two women who eventually put him away for 23 years, and again, that's been set aside now, Jessica Mann and Miriam Haley, we also had problems with both of their testimony and their stories, which to us didn't add up at all. Basically, you had a situation where Jessica Mann was the more serious one. Miriam Haley was the less serious one. One of those, Jessica Mann, he got 20 years for Jessica Mann. He got 3 years for Miriam Haley. But, you know, you're meant to, and Jessica Mann, they did this whole thing about she was from a dairy farm. She was from a very religious background. It was all this kind of thing. But mainly what struck me was that after the alleged assault, and for years and years, and there's so much to say here, there's so many details here, but for years and years afterwards, Jessica Mann sent hundreds of emails to Weinstein, and not in one did she even hint at the fact that he had even hurt her or upset her or hurt her feelings. And her story involved, you know, it was at the DoubleTree Hotel in New York City, and the story goes that basically he raped her. Afterwards, they went for breakfast with her and her friends. And okay, you can kind of maybe go with that, that was some kind of whatever, that she couldn't get out of it or whatever. But she took the guy who had brought her to New York, Tommy, she brought him aside and said to him after the breakfast or during the breakfast, "Can you do me a favor, Tommy? Can you I want to change my flight. I don't want to leave today." So she had the opportunity to get out of Dodge, to get out of New York, to get away from her rapist, basically. Mm-hmm. And she asked to change her flights. Now, why did she ask to change the flight? She asked her to change her flight so that she could celebrate Harvey Weinstein, the rapist's birthday the following day. So this is what the jury heard, what we heard, what we saw presented as evidence. And I think one of the, and there was tons and tons of stories similar to that. The Miriam Haley thing that strikes me is that Miriam Haley, you know, was assaulted. She asked afterwards if, you know, they would fly her to Los Angeles. She went to Los Angeles. She was there for 2 weeks. She comes back. She has consensual sex with Harvey Weinstein 2 weeks later. Then she asks if she could go to London. The Weinstein company fly her to London. When she's in London, she writes and says, "Oh, I've just discovered that Harvey's going to be in London next week. I want to change my flight so I'm here when he's here." So if any of that strikes you as normal, you know, do let me know, because very, very odd. And, you know, and all through the years, there was a lot of these requests, you know, "Can you get me into the Soho Club? Can I go to this premiere in Cannes?"
Can I just say something? People might think it's very odd that we're somehow standing up for Harvey Weinstein. I mean, you know, actually, and we've said it before, he's a pig, and he is a pig, but as they say, don't wrestle with pigs, because you'll end up in the mud and they'll enjoy it. I mean, you know, us supporting Harvey Weinstein. Look, this is mob justice. This is a DA in New York bowing to political pressure to try and imprison and ruin the person that all the progressives hate at that moment. Does that sound familiar? This is the same district attorney's office, the same prosecutors that are currently prosecuting Donald Trump, I think in exactly the same courtroom.
Yes.
In the same building.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, yeah.
So Harvey Weinstein, this is what they do. They open the door by picking a villain that conservatives will never care about. And then they put the rest of us through that ringer. So Donald Trump is now, is the natural follow-on from Harvey Weinstein. We didn't object when they had a trial in New York where Weinstein couldn't get a fair trial. Trump can't get a fair trial in New York. We didn't object when they stretched the law and stretched the law and stretched the law to bring in dodgy evidence against Harvey Weinstein. These Molina witnesses, and then there was a whole Sandoval ruling as well. So Sandoval is, if you're going to get up and claim your innocence in court, we can bring up not just prior bad acts involving alleged sexual assault, but prior bad acts in your life. So they were literally going to be able to bring up to him the fact that he once had a fist fight with his brother, the fact that he once thrown a phone at an assistant, the fact that he once thrown an assistant out of a car.
That he hadn't paid some bills sometimes.
And he hadn't paid some bills. So every bad thing he's ever done in his life was going to be put before the jury. Yeah. And he was going to have to answer to it. And it's like,
In essence, that's why this is important, is that, you know, they came for him, they're coming for you next.
And they're coming for...
And your brother.
And Trump.
Yeah.
So we could go on. We won't. But don't forget, Harvey Weinstein, they came for Harvey Weinstein. They came for Kevin Spacey, and you may think why we did the Kevin Spacey podcast as well. The exact law that they tried to get Kevin Spacey under was the one that E. Jean Carroll went after Trump with. It was, they got rid of the statute of limitations. Spacey was charged with doing something under civil legislation, charged with doing something 30 or 40 years ago. The same with Trump. Who can defend themselves against an allegation mm-hmm. that you were at a certain place at a certain time 30 or 40 years ago? Who knows where you were then? So this is what they do. They go for one of their own, and then they use that precedent to go after all of us. So that's why you should care about the Harvey Weinstein trial. Listen to the Harvey Weinstein trial Unfiltered, our podcast. Listen to the Kevin Spacey trial Unfiltered. And
We might play a clip from the Harvey Weinstein trial Unfiltered to give you an essence of, and I think what we might choose here is a little bit of the back and forth with Jessica, I think with Jessica Mann, mm-hmm. yeah, being questioned about her correspondence with Weinstein. And I think it's very interesting. It also gives you a chance to hear the quality. If you haven't heard the Harvey Weinstein trial Unfiltered, it'll give you an idea of the quality of it. Let's listen to that.
There was another email today that was extraordinary, and I think we'd heard about this. We'd actually heard this in the opening, where Jessica Mann, you know, again after the alleged rape, had got in touch with Harvey Weinstein.
The alleged rapes, you know,
and the alleged rapes actually, yes, had got in touch with Harvey Weinstein, wanting him to meet her mother.
And it's not just would you meet my mother. It's a very kind of friendly.
Yeah, actually, you get a really good sense of how, you know,
playful.
How, you know, well, you know, it's interesting to hear the actual words of the people, you know, who are in the court today, obviously spoken by the actors. But let's hear just the way these two spoke to each other, the kind of language they used to use when they communicated. Let's listen to that now.
Jessica, on July 26th of 2014, you sent a message to Harvey Weinstein that just said, "Hi." Do you remember that? Do you remember that email, that series of emails?
Yes, I do.
Jessica, you started off that, "Hi." Harvey responded back, "Where were you? How are you?" You said, "I am at work. Just had you cross my mind and thought I would send a hello. I am well." And he responded to you, "Love to cross your mind. It is my favorite exercise." You said, "LOL. That made me laugh so hard." And then you asked him, "When are you back? Never know what you are up to these days, correct?"
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And then he tells you when he is going to be in town, correct?
Yes.
And you told him that your mom is in town and that it would be great if he could see your mom?
Yes.
And you said she would love to meet you. Plus, you can see how good my jeans are, and you talked about where you would meet him, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and I have to say, that particular clip I particularly like, because the idea that you would be raped by someone and then afterwards you would say to your rapist, "I'd really like you to meet my mother." Yes. Doesn't add up for me. And it shouldn't add up for anyone, and it shouldn't have added up for the jury.
What I particularly like is the way the mainstream, I mean, that was another thing. I mean, we'll stop talking about this now, but it was the silence of the laptops, Clarice.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Yes.
We were in that court, 75.
Stuffed into the court.
Packed, you know, COVID central. And all you could hear when the
prosecution were asking tough questions,
complainants were giving their stories, it was crack, 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 crack. It was just these loud laptops. And then when the defense would get up and ask these questions, complete silence, the silence of the laptops. As I said on another podcast, these were activists with typewriters. They weren't journalists.
Yeah.
And I think the New York Times, I'm just looking, I just looked at the New York Times there before I came on, the offense, you know, that they haven't apologized. They're saying, well, it's no big shock that he was clear. And I'm going, well, you never told your readers that. But then they've sort of changed tack now. The offense that Harvey Weinstein can never be convicted of, and that's basically him being a sexist. And that's not really the point. And
But honestly, do listen to the Harvey Weinstein trial Unfiltered, because it is actually amazing. I'm just looking at my notes here and just remembering. Miriam Haley, by the way, the other accuser, she wrote multiple emails to Harvey Weinstein afterwards, asking him, could he give her a job? You know, that she was had been trained as a, some kind of specialist yoga thing, and would he give her a job? But all of her letters were at, all her emails to Harvey Weinstein, the guy that was apparently sexually assaulted her, ended with lots of love, either lots of love or peace and love. Peace again, love. You know, seems to be extraordinary that that's how you would address.
Which one of them changed her phone number 5 times and then wrote to Harvey Weinstein?
I think that that's Miriam Haley, but I'm not. Yeah. I would
so one of his victims changed her, you know, her phone. When you're a young transient actress in New York, in LA, you change your phone
Jessica
number.
Mann. Jessica Mann changed her phone. I'll read it to you because it's actually really good to say that. Between 2013 and 2017, she changed her phone 5 times. And in each time, she sent the new number to Harvey Weinstein. Again, completely unnecessarily. But this is what she did, and we're meant to believe that she was raped by that guy. And again, that's the woman, Jessica Mann, also was the one who wanted him, really, 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 really wanted him to meet her mother.
Yeah.
So okay.
We told you so. Let's do another We Told You So.
Yes,
we're now going to interview Bev Jackson of the LGB Alliance. That's after a UK report, the CAS report, basically came out and said what we've been saying all along, what many people have been saying all along, this trans madness is madness. It's mutilating children. It's mutilating distressed children. It's destroying lives. It's destroying human beings. And it's a social contagion. The CAS report, which is a summary of all the studies into the trans issue and trans medicalization in the UK and the world, has come out and said this is wrong and has to stop. So we're going to go over now to an interview we just recorded with Bev Jackson from the LGB Alliance. Let's go over that interview now. We're joined now by Bev Jackson, co-founder of the LGB Alliance. I think it's fair to say that the LGB Alliance, which is a UK charity, it's been at the forefront of the fight back against the trans madness, the ideology that's taken over the world, and I would say they're really the people to thank for the CAS report. Or certainly, I would think, but I want to talk to Bev about that, whether there would have been a CAS report without them agitating. They've worked tirelessly to protect children. They are also heavily featured in our play Mermaids versus the Alliance that premiered in London last summer. It was their court case. And I think you could even see the beginning, as Churchill would say, the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning, in that court case, just how thin the ideology was. So Bev is a former university lecturer in English literature. She's a translator and longtime LGB activist. As I said, she was part of the Mermaids lawsuit. Just to remind you, the Mermaids was a trans child activist organization that tried to put the LGB Alliance out of business or out of existence for daring to stand up for children. So welcome to the show, Bev. Very exciting times.
Very nice. Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
So this is mostly an American audience that we deal with. Can you explain to listeners who may not be familiar with the CAS report, where did it come out of, what is it, and why it's such a big deal?
Well, first of all, I really don't want to take credit for the CAS report. I'm not a clinician. I'm a gay rights activist, gay and lesbian rights activist. And many clinicians have been whistleblowers and have been wanting to have a systematic review of this kind for some time. I do think we have played a role.
Yes.
And the role that we've played is that when we started off LGB Alliance in 2019, Kate Harris and I, there were just the two of us, two lesbians. We had no backing, we had no support, we had no money, we had nothing. What we had was a conviction that the organizations that were supposed to be standing up for gay rights were no longer doing so. They were no longer doing so. They were actually doing the opposite and actually working against the rights and interests of gays and lesbians. That sounds so crazy that when I first say that, people say, what? How is that possible? And they wouldn't talk to us about it. We tried and tried to talk about it, and they didn't want to talk to us. So one of the most horrendous things was that we realized that the that teenage lesbian and gay kids were being medicalized. What? Why? You don't need to be to medicalize gay and lesbian teens. And you'd think that all the organizations that care about gays and lesbians would say, no, no, you don't need to do that. They weren't. They were doing the opposite. And so this became one of the most important things for us to say, hang on, what's happening to these kids? And why is nobody paying attention? Everybody has always known that most of the kids presenting to gender clinics with what they used to call gender identity disorder, then they called it gender dysphoria, now they're calling it gender incongruence. I don't know why they keep changing the name, but anyway, everyone has always known that those kids are what we call gender non-conforming. In other words, interesting kids. They don't conform to gender stereotypes. They're interesting kids. And they don't need medicalizing. And even Mermaids, the child, the gender charity, used to say in the year 2000, most of those kids will not need medicalizing. Most of them will simply grow up to be gay or lesbian. That's what they said 20 odd years ago. Mm-hmm. And they completely changed a while back. Now, what is the CAS review? It's a systematic review to look at all the studies that have been done that are supposedly to prove the benefits of puberty blockers in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And why was it necessary? It was necessary because of the huge scandal that erupted around the GIDS, the gender development service of the Tavistock Clinic, in which it turned out that kids were just not being given proper care. They were being rushed through in what's called diagnostic overshadowing. I'm going to use this term, which your listeners, your viewers may not be familiar with, but I think it's really important because these are kids that have a variety of problems. They may have depression, they may have anxiety, they may have abuse in the family. A lot of them have been in care, so in foster care or what have you. Some 30% of them are on the autism spectrum, mm-hmm. and the vast majority of them have same-sex sexual orientation. If you ask them, mm-hmm. many gender clinics don't even ask, but those that do, oh, it's mostly they're mostly same-sex. Yeah, I'm sorry, I go on.
The actual problem was the question was so big. There was about three...
You asked too many questions.
Three parts to the question.
Yeah.
No, I suppose the situation as it was in the UK and as it is in America and other countries is that at some point the world changed and teenagers and children who didn't, I mean, this is the crazy thing, who didn't conform to gender stereotypes. When I was growing up, it was the whole thing about not giving girls dolls, giving them trucks and cars. remember there was a phase of that?
Yeah.
And you give boys dolls just not to conform with gender stereotypes. Of course, the boys ripped the head of the doll and set it on fire, right? Because that's what boys do. You didn't do that.
Not all boys.
No, but I'm just, you know, the idea was it was cool that your child wouldn't, you would try and make your child not conform. It was mostly to protect young women, I suppose, so that they could go into math and they could go into science. That was the idea was it was great that children. Now you see in these interviews with people, she didn't like dresses. She liked to wear, you know, overalls or whatever, and she liked to be out in threes. And suddenly they're on a fast track to puberty blockers and to medicalization of not conforming to gender stereotypes. So therefore they must be a boy. There's no idea that there could be a thing called a tomboy, or that could be a I don't know if this is a proper phrase, the butch lesbian type. Those were just pushed aside. Everything was on the gender medicalization fast track. And we've now had, is it a generation of young children mutilated in one of the biggest medical scandals of the last several decades?
That's exactly right. It's a huge medical scandal. And it's only starting to pierce the consciousness. I want to differentiate a little bit between the United States and Europe. Mm-hmm. So we have quite a lot of studies that have been done in Sweden and in Finland and in France and now in the UK, which show, as Cass shows very clearly, there is no evidence base that puberty blockers do good. They do not help kids' well-being. And there's quite a lot of evidence that they do harm. They lead to they harm the bone density. They lead to cognitive impairment. And if carried on and to cross-sex hormones, which most kids who take puberty blockers do, they lead to infertility, sometimes urinary incontinence and sexual dysfunction, and so many other things, and many health risks. Now this path is called in the United States gender affirming care, mm-hmm. which sounds nice. Oh, that sounds nice. Gender affirming care. We should be caring. We should affirm. We should be nice. It goes along with be kind and, you know, gender affirming care. And it's pushed by WPATH. There is no evidence base for it. And WPATH, which pretends to be a world impartial body, professional body. It calls itself the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. Sounds very impressive. But when you look at it, you see it's a lobby group. It pushes this particular so-called gender-affirming care. And it pushes the idea that still lives, I think, in America, that some children, some poor children, are born in the wrong body. Mm-hmm. Nobody is born in the wrong body. You can't be born in the wrong body any more than you can be born in the wrong country or in the, you know, it's just the wrong planet. It's just nonsense. And in fact, Dr. David Bell, the very eminent psychiatrist who has been the whistleblower, really a very prominent whistleblower. He was a former governor of the Tavistock and Portman Trust. He has gone as far as to say, everybody around the world has to stop talking about trans children. He says there are no trans children. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He says there are children who are troubled, who are distressed for all sorts of reasons.
Yes.
And what happens is that they come to a gender clinic and all their other problems are just ignored as soon as they say the magic word gender. And that is what we call diagnostic overshadowing. Everybody zooms in on the gender and thinks that that is the cause of all the other problems. Well, yeah, and it is a scandal. It's a, yeah.
I mean, why did this? I mean, I just find it really bizarre to have watched this happening in real time. Why did this take off at such a rate? Why is this such an epidemic? It's like, you know, it reminds me, I always compare it to eugenics, which was another awful idea, which became extremely popular the enlightened among us, by the way, like the cleverest people in the world were all in favor of eugenics. What's your explanation for how all of the major institutions have been captured by this?
Yeah. Obviously, there's many different explanations because it's such a complex phenomenon. And some people focus on demand and other people focus on supply. Now, if you look at the supply side, you see a lot of money pouring into this. You see a lot of money. And there, a lot of people are getting very wealthy on this. There were 15 years ago, there was, I think, one youth gender clinic in the United States, and there's now, I think, over 100. So everybody who is involved in that, the people who are running the clinics, the clinicians, the endocrinologists, the surgeons are doing quite well out. It's a billion-dollar industry. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, and so, but there's also the demand side. Why are kids sucked into this? Now, part of that is online influencers. And let me just take one person, for instance, a YouTube influencer called Alex Bertie. It's a very typical story. If you look, there was a Times article written about Alex Bertie in 2017. Around the age of 12, 13, for the first time, she realizes that she feels something for another girl. She wrestles with this. When it becomes known, she's bullied mercilessly at school for 3 years. and she becomes depressed, self-harms, is really in a terrible state. She gets referred to an LGBT group and they give her literature about transitioning, and that becomes the answer, and she decides to so-called change into a boy. And let's be clear, nobody can change sex. Yeah. It is ridiculous. It is a lie that is being sold to some of the most vulnerable people in our society. Mm-hmm. And it's supposedly progressive. There is nothing progressive about this. This is not a progressive movement. It is the opposite. Mm-hmm. And the movements that should, the groups that should be protecting gay and lesbian teens from this kind of rubbish, like GLAAD, like the HRC, and like the ACLU, they have all bought into this nonsense, and they push and push and push, and they say these poor kids, they must have their drugs, and anyone who wants to stop them getting their drugs is an evil, horrible, nasty bigot. And I've been called every name under the sun for not wanting these children to be medicalized. It is really the upside down that we're in here.
Do you think the tide is turning now because of the CAS report?
Well, it's certainly turning in the UK. I think that's very clear. But the UK is kind of a standout in this area. I don't live in the UK. I live in the Netherlands. But I co-founded together with Kate Harris, LGB Alliance in the UK, because it is possible to set up an organisation like that there. And why is that? It's partly because the UK is a very secular country, kind of suspicious of weird ideologies, not very religious at all. In fact, one of the least religious countries in the world. I think that's important. It has a big left-wing women's movement. And, you know, I want to be clear. I mean, we are a non-politically aligned organization, but most of us come from the left. We are very supportive of women's reproductive rights. And we have been always, and we will remain so. But we work across, all political parties, because this is not a political issue. It has been in America. And because in the United States, it is so heavily politicized, the GOP has captured this item, and it's made it into its own item, which means that Democrats hardly dare to come out. But Democrats do reach out. We know that Democrats care about their kids just as much as Republicans do. They absolutely do. But these initiatives, which have been taken in red states to ban so-called gender-affirming care for children, are being blocked, or in some cases, or the attempts to block them, by the very organizations that should be standing up for these kids. Yeah. And that is a secondary scandal.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you about that, actually. That was one of my questions. Why did the left in the UK, or certain sections of the left in the UK, go behind? Because, as you say, you're an outlier, that it was people from the left who were, well, it was also people from the right, but certainly at the forefront of the opposition to this were old lefties from the 80s and the 70s and 80s. I mean, or even new, are you saying, our new lefties like J.K. Rowling, you know, progressives like J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter book. And like, I look at J.K. Rowling's Twitter feed and I'm going, why are you doing this, J.K. Rowling? Like, you had a wonderful life and have a wonderful life, and you're putting yourself on Twitter to get dogs abuse. And, you know, it's comfortable being an old lefty. It's comfortable being a new lefty. You know, you get invited to all.
Why do you think she does it, Phelan? Why do you think she does it?
I suppose there's two questions. Why does she do it? Why does she do it? Why do people like you do it? But why do you think you started to do it? Because here in the US, where we are, you're right. It's become this left-right issue, but the key I think in the UK was it was lefties and progressives who suddenly goes, there's something not right here. What do you think was particular about was in the British water, and that made you think like that? And why? I mean, it must have been terrible for you guys, because I'd say you've lost all your friends. We have no friends here, so we're okay. We never had any friends, but you must have lost a lot of friends over this.
I've lost one friend that I knew for over 50 years, a gay man who just thinks that I'm an evil bigot. And so, yes, that's very sad. We were very close friends. But no, I haven't lost that many friends. I have to say, it does take some time to explain to people why I'm doing what I'm doing. And if someone asks me, what is your organization? I never answer. I say, you know, if you'd like to know, it will take some time to explain.
Right.
So, because if you try and explain it in one sentence, it just won't work. I think that J.K. Rowling does it because it's necessary. She saw a necessity and she knew that she was able to, that she would be able to withstand the pressure. Mm. And the same goes for us, for Kate Harris and I. It's not an accident that we're not very young. We are not so vulnerable. For people who are young, they're trying to set up their careers.
Yeah.
They've got children who may be teased at school. There's so many vulnerabilities, especially in the United States, where their healthcare might be at issue if they lose their job. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very understandable why people in the United States, I mean, I'm very glad that is gradually changing and there are more more people on the Democratic side starting to speak out, but it has taken a long, long time. And so you asked me about where the movement, where it comes from. And I said on the supply side, there's a lot of money. Let's take the example of Stonewall. And Stonewall is the biggest British organization. It's huge, used to be very, very respectable gay rights organization. And then in 2015, under the new leadership of Ruth Hunt, it suddenly changed. And instead of promoting gay rights, it promoted gender identity theory. Gender identity theory is the idea that, and it kind of religious belief, that everyone has a gender identity. It's a kind of gendered soul that may be different from your actual sex and that matters more than your actual sex. That's what I call gender identity theory. And of course, I don't believe it. I don't have a gender identity and I'm not interested in that. It's sexist, regressive nonsense. But that is what has happened. Now, when Ruth Hunt became CEO of Stonewall, Arcus Foundation, quite a wealthy foundation, came up with $100,000 for her to switch course. And so she switched course and she embraced gender identity theory instead of gay rights. Because after all, there was no money in gay rights anymore.
That's right.
Once you've got same-sex marriage, what are you gonna work for?
Yeah.
Whoa, but you've got an organization with 150 people. Whoa, we don't want to fire them all, so we better have a new thing. We should be fighting homophobia around the world. There's like 69 countries that are still criminalizing homosexuality.
Yes.
That's what they should have done. There's no money in that. But there's lots of money in this new transgender thing, this gender identity. Let's do that. And that's what she did.
That's very interesting.
And she is responsible for what happened in the UK. We hold her responsible for that.
That's very interesting what you said there. That's, you know, basically, yeah, like, so a charity that sort of solves the main problem that they were set up to solve. You know, what do you do next? And as you say, though, the problem isn't solved, you know, when they're throwing gay people off buildings and stoning women to death.
Exactly.
You know, there is, and by the way, and actually, I'm really glad you actually mentioned that, because I mean, that's really hard work that needs to be done and is not being done.
Yes.
I mean, no one's hearing anything about that.
No, it isn't. Exactly. And we are a tiny, tiny charity. I would like your listeners to know that in contrast to Stonewall, which has 100 something, you know, so maybe probably fewer people now, but it did have 150 at its height. We've got two members of staff. We are a tiny, tiny little charity. So we would love to fight homophobia around the world, but we simply hardly have the resources, especially since we are under attack again and again. By the way, we are not allowed on the BBC, at least. That may be changing now.
Unbelievable.
Things seem to be changing a little bit, but we haven't been on the BBC. We've never, ever been on not allowed for 1 minute on BBC
You've not
TV
been on,
just, since we started. Never.
LGB
never.
Alliance, so the CAST report has come out, and I know I was probably exaggerating a little
to say
that you were the impetus behind the CAST. You weren't the impetus behind the CAST report, but if you hadn't existed, I wonder if there would have been a CAST report, mm-hmm. right? Let's just
say
that.
Well, I think it is true that we've given sort of cover, if you like.
Yes.
I mean, because before we came along, People who opposed gender identity theory were called homophobic because all the gay rights charities were now embracing it. So it looked like, oh, you must be anti-gay if you don't like gender identity. Yes. And it is difficult to explain to people. Yes. And then when we came along and said, no, we're gays and lesbians and bisexuals, and we think gender identity is a load of nonsense and it's harmful nonsense, and we oppose it, and we don't think children need to be taught that they might have 100 different gender identities and all this stuff.
Yeah,
so people dared to speak out and say, oh, it's not homophobic. And so I do think that we played that role, and it was an important role. I don't want to underplay our role, but I also don't want to be too arrogant. There were so many people.
You can let us, we can overplay your role.
Yes, yes.
But I mean, you say so many things, you know, you've so many sentences there, and there's so many things.
Sorry.
No. What I mean is you make such great points. I mean, you talked about Stonewall there and money. And of course, I mean, I remember, a long time ago, 10 years ago, we were meeting a big donor in America, a big donor. It was in a diner in Texas. And these are billionaires with a B. And they said the one thing they don't like is they give people money to solve a problem. What's the first thing they do is they set up a charity with a 401k, right? And that's a pension plan. And he looks at them and goes, why are you setting up a charity with a pension plan? Aren't you going to, I'm giving you money. Aren't you going to solve this problem in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? What do you need pensions for? Surely the idea is to wind down the charity.
Yeah.
Right. When you've solved the problem.
Yeah, the mission statement should be that that you're going to solve the problem, that, you know, within a period of time, you're going to solve the problem and you're going to make your jobs obsolete.
Yeah. And Stonewall obviously had solved the problem in the UK. And rather, nobody wants to go to Iran. Nobody wants to go to Uganda and campaign there. It's dirty, terrible,
dangerous.
Dangerous. There's no Tesco's, you know. I mean, well, it's just appalling, right? The humanity, right? And nobody wants to go there. But if you can sit at home and attack and become cool promoting transgender stuff. But also there's another thing. Stonewall had a nice little earner. Like, it's like the racism business here, the DEI business here, where you go up to Pepsi Cola or the local university and say, nice little business you have here. Wouldn't you like a DEI consultant? And we can come and give you DEI classes for $20,000 an afternoon. And Stonewall had infiltrated all these organizations, hadn't they? And were making lots of money.
I don't think that's the right way. I don't think infiltration is the right way to look at it. Don't forget, Stonewall used to be a really good organization. It was a terrific organization. Mm-hmm. It promoted gay rights. It really made a difference to British society. It helped fight Clause 28. It didn't infiltrate. It helped all these companies and organizations know better how to help their gay and lesbian employees. So that was fine. It didn't cost anything. Mm-hmm. It was simply a service, and it was an excellent mm-hmm. thing. But then when they changed, and then suddenly instead of promoting gay rights, they were promoting something completely weird and actually rather terrible, nobody noticed. In fact, quite a lot of people still haven't noticed because they just think it's the same old Stonewall. It's got that name, Stonewall. Well, that's a good ring to it.
But they get paid now for going to educate companies, don't they? And they get paid.
Yeah. That now they demand a certain amount of money. So the company pays a certain amount of money. The company then is instructed on the kind of things they have to do. For instance, not use the word woman, but call them uterus, havers or something ridiculous. And then as long as they follow the rules and they've got gender neutral toilets and stuff like this, then they get ranked higher on the Workplace Equality Index. And so they want to be top 100 Stonewall employers. Yeah. So it's a circular, it's a scam. Protection racket. Sorry.
No, you're right. It's a scam. It's a scam. And just like, you know, yeah, it's a scam and it's a moneymaker. So what next? Where are we going now? Is the madness over? Or I mean, are you going to get on the BBC? I mean, and I mean that as a joke.
Well, it would be nicer. It would be nice because honestly, whenever we, if we are on the BBC, if we were on the BBC for 2 minutes, we, I mean, millions and millions of. Well, in fact, Kate Harris was on BBC Radio very briefly after our court case, and we were flooded with letters from people saying, thank you, that's so interesting. And, you know, because once people hear what we're talking about, they know that we're not hateful bigots. Yeah. You know, there are trans people. I've never known so met so many interesting trans people as I have in the last 5 years. Mm. And many deeply troubled by what's happening with children, but also very conflicted, not really able to speak out. Because if you're a trans identifying person and you speak out, then you find yourself vilified by everybody on all sides. And you just, it's such a lonely place to be. But I've met some of them and they're wonderful people. I do want to say, though, although we don't get, we have had much more media coverage in the last year than we've had in the past. I think people are starting to realize that we're talking sense and that the people who have been selling this gender identity stuff are selling something which is really harmful, especially to children. But we do have an annual conference in London every year at the QE2 Centre, which is close to the Houses of Parliament. This year it's on the 11th of October. And I very much hope that any of your listeners or viewers who are in London around that time will want to get a ticket and come to what is always a very inspiring event. I remember the guy who was running the video said, you know, he has to do this for conferences all the time. He said he'd never seen such an interesting conference. And yes. It's always that's right. It's great fun, and you meet lots of interesting people.
You always know you're doing something worthwhile when the guy who does the sound, or you know, because they're always sitting there chewing gum, just bored, you know, because they've done a million conferences, and then suddenly one of them goes, "Wow, that's an amazing story." It's the biggest compliment in journalism as well. We used to have to phone in stories to copy takers, and the copy takers would never respond. When the copy taker would go, that's interesting.
Yeah,
you go, yes, this is a great story. So well done.
I want to say something else about the atmosphere in which all this has happened. This is an age of misogyny. It's the worst age of misogyny in my lifetime. I've never seen anything like it. And what the Biden administration has done with Title IX, which has gutted women's rights in the United States, is absolutely outrageous. And thank goodness for Reem Al-Salem, the UN Special Representative for Violence Against Women and Girls, she speaks out. Most people at the United Nations are, you know, putting forward men as the Woman of the Year. But no, she speaks out, and she's been absolute heroine of this movement. She's so isolated at the UN, and I want to just pay tribute to her, because this is an age of misogyny in which it's women. If I take a man's name and I say the same sort of things that I normally say, I will not get one tenth of the abuse. Women get extraordinary abuse all day long.
I was just about to wrap up, but you've put some temptation.
Sorry, but I just thought I can't stop mentioning their misogyny.
This is the trans women. They're basically stereotypes, parodies of women. You know,
but also they're stealing. So they're stealing, you know, women's prizes in athletics. They're stealing, as you said, you know, the woman of the year here, there, and everywhere turns out to be a man. All these competitions have been won now by men, and it's
and you've got the Assistant Secretary for Health, Admiral Rachel Levine. Pompously maintaining that puberty blockers are safe. That is somebody in a position of real influence who is doing real harm in the United States. So, I know I have no right to talk about the United States, so I'll stop now.
Yes, you do. It's a free country. Tell people what Biden has done with Title IX, actually, just before we go, because we should have talked about that. But please go ahead.
Well, instead of protect... Title IX protects sex, women's sex-based rights, and he's changed it to gender identity, which basically gets rid of women's sex-based rights. As soon as you change, anyone who changes sex to gender identity is basically throwing women's rights overboard. That's the end of women's rights. Yeah. And it means it's the end of women's sport. It's the end of any women's protections. And that is the world that we're living in. And I have to say that, you know, in the United States, where you have the Republicans attacking women's reproductive rights, and you have the Democrats attacking the very definition of what it is to be a woman, it's a very hard time to be a woman in the United States with an election coming up.
Well, look, there's a lot. Every time you speak, I want to come back and say something else, but we really have to stop it. I mean, you said earlier, you know, it's older people who can. I know lots of young women, and there was a young woman who's a relatively famous actress who came to the play at in London, and I won't name her. And you know, she doesn't want to speak out. You know, she's because her career would be over. Like her career would be over, and it's a really tough time to be a woman who wants to protect other women.
And I just want to say one thing in closing, please, let's get rid of these stupid initials LGBTQIA+ two spirit whatever. These things do not belong together. These are conflicting interests. LGB do not belong with all these other initials. LGB is about sexual orientation, and all these identities, they should have their own groups. That's absolutely fine. But LGB needs to split from TQ+. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Look, thank you very much. How do people get in touch with you? How do they find you on social media, etc.?
Well, I'm on Twitter, because I don't like calling it X, which at Bev Jackson Auth. So Bev Jackson, AUTH. And you can also please do go to LGB Alliance's website, lgballiance.org.uk, lgballiance.org.uk. Please remember our conference on the 11th of October. You can look at on our YouTube channel and see previous videos from earlier conferences, and that will, I think, make you determined to come.
Great. Very well. Yeah, so I would argue, though, that Twitter is now identifying as X.
Exactly. Anyway. Thanks so much, Bev.
Thanks, Bev.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye. Thank you.
Well, that was a great interview. As Bev said, you know, they're old lefties, and obviously when she talks about reproductive rights, she's talking about abortion there. We didn't want to get into that conversation because actually it wasn't the venue for it. There was so much in what she was saying. We wanted to focus it on the LGB Alliance and the mutilation of children. We can talk about
trans issue.
And the trans issue. Perhaps we'll have Bev back on another occasion to talk about abortion, or she calls it reproductive rights. But it is very interesting, and I think that's the way ahead for America. We need to get the lefties involved in this. Mm-hmm. It needs to become a cross-party issue. It needs to become an issue about children and humanity. So think about that the next time maybe that you're talking about this. Try and not polarize. Don't hold back what you think, but try and embrace, try and bring in the lefties, because it was actually the lefties getting behind it in the UK. The lefties everywhere control the media, they control the arts, and it just they control the very powerful NGO world. So if you can try to pull out the blocks in those worlds, the thing crumbles, because it's a very, very weak ideology. So we're at the end.
For this week. The play does open this week, as we said before. It opens tomorrow, October 7, theplay.com, and please share, buy tickets and donate, because we really need help to make this a success.
Actually, let's play the trailer as a farewell. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
The world wants you to forget what happened in Israel on October 7th. We've covered many shocking stories, but nothing comes close to what the men, women and children of Israel faced that day. We're investigative journalists, Anne McElhenney and Phelan McAleer.
We travelled to Israel after October the 7th and talked to those who lived through that day. Their stories are tragic, they are moving, and they are heroic. They are also very, very compelling.
We've produced a play from their stories. Our verbatim play, October 7, consists entirely of eyewitness accounts of that day, only using the actual words of those who lived through it. The world wants you to forget about what happened that day, the day that everything changed. We refuse to let that happen.
October 7, the play is opening in New York and will bring you the truth they don't want you to hear.
Get your tickets now for October 7, the play at October7theplay.com, running May 2nd to June 16th in New York.
That's October7theplay.com. Thank you.